Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is July 20th, 2020, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is EBM and the Changing Man. And our guest skeptic is Professor Simon Carley. He is the creator, webmaster, owner, and editor-in-chief of the amazing blog and podcast known as St. Emlyn's. He is a professor of emergency medicine at the Manchester Metropolitan University and a consultant in adult and pediatric emergency medicine at Manchester Foundation Trust. Dr. Carley is even verified on Twitter as @EMManchester. Welcome to the SGEM, Simon.
Thank you so much for having me here, Ken. It's always a pleasure to be on what I believe, and I will tell everybody, is the premier evidence-based medicine podcast in the world, the SGEM. It's a delight to do anything with you, Ken. I've chatted with you, I've presented with you, I've taught with you, I've podcasted with you, whatever we do, it's all good.
Well, I have to say, it is so great to have one of the giants of the FOMED world back on the SGEM.
Too kind, Ken. Maybe not a giant, maybe just old.
Well, last time you were here was way, way, way back. I mean, about 150 podcasts ago, SGEM number 148.
Yeah, and that was a great episode we did about using skin glue for peripheral IVs. Really good fun. And we decided that, the bottom line, skin glue did appear to decrease the failure rate of IVs in patients admitted to hospital from the ED. And we had a little think about it. We didn't know whether it was a good idea for all ED patients, and we didn't know the true effect size. But for high-stakes cannulas that we really want to stay in, we thought it should be considered. And I've certainly done it since. I've done it in some central lines particularly, and also arterial lines, more commonly than IVs, but it's certainly something I've adopted.
Well, this is an SGEM Extra, and it's based on the wonderful article you, Daniel Horner, Rick Boddy, and Kevin McWay-Jones wrote for the BMJ Emergency Medicine Journal. This article was titled Evidence-Based Medicine and COVID-19, What to Believe and When to Change. Can you give us an elevator pitch on what this article is all about?
Yeah, sure. The basis of this article was really that we're going through such an incredible period of history. It's, well, we hope probably just a once-in-a-lifetime experience, when we're kind of seeing the powers of nature, medicine, invention, ingenuity, well, they're all coming together to combat this pandemic, or to create it, in fact. And it's shaken up the way that we think about medicine, how it's practiced. And for us, when we consider ourselves EBM clinicians, just like you, we saw decisions being made on all aspects of the pandemic that seemed to be based on little, or in some cases, no evidence. And it seemed that we'd gone back 20 years to a time when opinion was more important than science. And that made us, you know, really uncomfortable. And we felt we had to get out there and revisit what EBM really means and why the principles of EBM are as important now as ever. In fact, arguably even more important now than it's ever been.
Was there something specific that inspired you, though, to write the article?
I think there were lots of reasons that came together, but I think it was when we started seeing guidelines, national guidelines and policy being changed without us actually having seen the base data and the evidence. And we were seeing expert groups recommend therapies, which really had very little data on them. Things like hydroxychloroquine is a good example. There were lots of people suggesting this would be a great idea. And at the same time, we thought, this is madness. We saw a huge opportunity for us to actually test these therapies properly. And that was being missed. And we thought, if we miss that opportunity now to test these therapies, it's gone. And we may end up in a world where we've adopted therapies, which now are apparently gold standard, with little evidence and with no impetus to find out whether they're better, worse, or the same, or what comes in the future. So for us, it was really tough. And just on one other thing, Ken, you know, it's a paradox, isn't it? This COVID-19 pandemic is awful. I've seen some horrific things. I've dealt with some horrible stuff, as we all have. But on the other hand, as a scientist, as a clinician, as a researcher, as an educator, this is an incredible opportunity for us to show what we can do with those tools to help patients and clinicians. And so we're sort of both horrified and self-actualized in this COVID pandemic. And all of those things came together to bring this article to publication.
Well, one thing I really liked about your article is that up front, you defined evidence-based medicine so everybody could be on the same page. Our good friends Justin Morgenstern from First 10 EM and Casey Parker from Broom Docs recently did a podcast called EBM 2.0. Now, listening to that episode, Simon, I almost drove the car off the road. Now, it was a really good podcast. I really, really enjoyed it. But they didn't define EBM up front. And I think what they were really diving into in that episode was talking about some of the problems with the literature. What did you use as a definition of EBM to start your paper?
So we went back to Dave Sackett, 1996. EBM is the conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of current best evidence in making decisions about the care of individual patients. And that's the one which we were happy to stand behind.
And the literature is just one of three pillars of EBM. And there are many problems and limitations with medical research. And this includes the dreaded dun-dun-dun p-value, or the dichotomization. Biases like publication bias, financial conflicts of interest, spectrum bias, and of course the replication crisis. I mean, if you get across that magical 0.05 p-value, spike the ball, we're done, we ignore all the previous literature and go with that one publication. However, the other two pillars of EBM are equally as important, and that includes things like clinical judgment and the patient's values and preferences. Did you actually hear the show with Justin and Casey, and do you have any comments?
Yeah, so I've been following this EBM 2.0 conversation for a couple of months now, I think. And I think it's fascinating. The podcast, the blog, and also Dr. Senthi's presentations around EBM 2.0, because I think he's been leading it. They've got some great points in there, and I found a lot of common ground with them, particularly, as you say, around the misinterpretation of what p-values, statistics, and the inferences that come from them actually mean. But in general, I actually thought this was largely a new way of thinking about really what Sackett and the original people who put together EBM coming out of clinical epidemiology in your part of the world, in Canada, it's what they really thought, but just with new ways of thinking and new examples. So I thought it's great to reiterate and repackage what EBM means, but I wasn't completely convinced it was entirely different. Apart from the concept that they had around the use of pretest probabilities, in that we should interpret a result of a trial based on what we knew about it before we started. And I kind of have some superficial attraction to that, is that the idea of when do you change? You don't change on a single paper or a single p-value. You've got to put it into context. And that's really important. And you know, it's something I totally believe in, this Bayesian process. But in order to do that, we've got to have some idea of how good is our belief before we started? And that's complex, particularly in something like COVID-19, where you might ask me, what do I think of hydroxychloroquine? And you might ask Donald Trump. And our pretest probabilities before we read the paper are going to be slightly different, very different, in fact. And so that concept I've struggled with a little bit. The point is, the decision to change an act is dependent on the people who make those decisions, not just the evidence. The patients, the clinicians, the health economies we work in, the managers, all of those factors, things like cost, they make a difference. It's not about the numbers. It's about the whole package. And on that point, I totally agree with them.
Well, I'm sure that I would ask you about your thoughts on hydroxychloroquine, and I'm equally sure that I would not ask Donald Trump. Now, let's get back to your paper now that we've got a definition of evidence-based medicine. The first section of your paper discusses knowledge translation during COVID-19 global pandemic. Now, I'm always saying it takes over 10 years for high-quality, clinically relevant information to reach the patient's bedside. And I'm trying to cut that KT window down to less than 1 year with the power of social media on the SGEM. But during a global pandemic, certainly we can't wait over 10 years.
No, we can't. But we don't need to. If you think about it, this is a unique opportunity. We're dealing with pretty much a single illness, or certainly a single organism, and we have lots of patients at the same time. We have a disease which has terrible consequences, but the consequences are known fairly soon, or if you're thinking about mortality, and that's a pretty hard outcome. So we've got a situation where we've got a unity of disease. We've got lots of patients in lots of different places with pretty hard outcomes. And we have the attention of the world. So in my head, and then you're going to talk about the practicalities, you can talk about those if you want. But if we can't do EBM now, if we can't recruit large numbers of people to trials and get good outcomes and look at the data and then make change, if we can't do it now, we probably never can. This is a huge opportunity for the world of evidence-based medicine to show what it's worth. And it doesn't mean we have to rate. And there are examples. Look at what the recovery trial, which we might talk about later, has shown with the use of dexamethasone in COVID-19 patients. So large, 12,000 patients now recruited to that trial, randomized to treatments. We can do EBM in a pandemic. In fact, I think we can do it better.
Well, information is often incomplete, weak, and limited. And evidence-based medicine, right there in the definition, it talks about using the best evidence. That does not mean we expect the evidence to be perfect before acting. This could be considered a nirvana logical fallacy.
Yeah, I read this and I thought, gosh, Ken, you know, this is exactly where we started, wasn't it? The idea that our practice should be based on the evidence. But for many people, including myself, a lot of the time, I don't actually know what the evidence is, and I don't know how strong it is. And part of our job as EBM clinicians is to work out systems and how we do that. We develop things like best bets, and I'm sure you're aware of that, Ken, where we ask very simple evidence-based questions, the PICO, and we tried to answer them. And in many occasions in emergency medicine, we demonstrated that the quality of the evidence wasn't that high, but it was as good as we had. And on the basis of as good as we had, we then made our decisions. But it also inspired us to try and make better evidence, to go out there and to do the research and to share that uncertainty. Because admitting that you're uncertain is not a bad thing. A lot of clinicians practice under what I call an illusion of certainty. They think that this drug will work every time in every patient, but it doesn't. We know that. But knowing that it's uncertain helps us be better clinicians, better researchers, and better educators. So things like best bets have been great, and I think we should be doing more and more of this.
I agree with the concept of embracing uncertainty. Simon, you and I both work in an emergency department, and we're used to making life and death decisions, often quickly, in seconds to minutes, with incomplete information. Perhaps that's why we as ED physicians are more comfortable with uncertainty.
Yeah, we talk about this concept of time-critical, information-light decision-making. And I think that's one of the things which is a real characteristic of what I define as a great emergency physician. They're people who are, I think, we're happy being wrong and then changing practice. Even during a single patient episode, we can change our mind. And we like handling conflicting information and then mentally simulating those decisions to decide what to do. And I think it's that skill that the best emergency physicians have. And I often think about it as what we want to be is we want to be right in the moment when we're making those decisions. Not when the retrospectoscope looks backwards. Our decision-making, information light, time critical, in the moment. That's what we do. Now, whether that's because we were born that way or trained that way, I don't know. But you know it when you see it.
Well, we all have biases, and we need to be careful to guard ourselves about our biases. And there's one bias that seems to have come up more in COVID-19. And that's the intervention bias, that we need to do something and that we need to intervene.
Yeah, and that's a problem, isn't it? I mean, we said in the paper that even not in COVID-19, I think we've seen a lot more of it in COVID-19. We do have this tendency to overestimate the benefit of an intervention and underestimate the potential harm. And for a lot of therapies that we give, you know, the numbers needed to treat may be 50, 60, 70, 80. Well, of course, that means that most people don't actually benefit from it, or the benefit is minimal. And in a pandemic, there's that pressure that we have to do something, that we have to be seen to be doing something. And if we do it, even if it makes no difference, we will then potentially attribute any potential benefit. So this patient survived because they got drug A. Well, unless we've tested it, we don't know whether drug A actually made no difference at all. So I think we've got to be incredibly cautious about this and be mindful that it's the human condition that is going to force it. It's our emotions that are going to make us want to believe, want to change, want to do stuff. But in many occasions, not doing something is the right thing to do until we've got better evidence.
Well, if you want to learn more about intervention bias in the practice of medicine, there's a great article by Foy and Philippone in the Yale Journal of Biology and Medicine. Now, I'll put a link in the show notes for you. This concept of intervention bias reminds me of one of my favorite concepts I learned from the legend of emergency medicine, Dr. Jerry Hoffman. Don't just do something, stand there. Our guest skeptic last week, Dr. Daniel Fadovich, wrote a great paper on this, and I'll throw that link in the show notes too. The next section of your paper, though, Simon, talks about precipitous decisions in COVID-19. Can you give us some examples?
I think there were many occasions during COVID-19, particularly in early stages, when we were making changes to recommendations to therapies before we had the data. And so we talk about a number of these in the paper, such as hydroxychloroquine. Remdesivir was adopted by many people before we had any evidence that it made a difference. And even then, when the data came out, it was released by press release. It was approved as a drug before we'd seen the data. And then when the data came out, it wasn't about mortality. We saw a lot of changes in the UK around thromboprophylaxis in these patients. So people adopting strategies to increase thrombolysis to therapeutic levels rather than prophylactic levels based on their D-dimers. There was little or no evidence for that, but it seemed like a great idea at the time. But that's potentially incredibly harmful to this group of patients. So there's lots and lots of directives that have come out from very well-meaning clinicians, organizations, politicians, health economists, to say we should do this, but without the data to be there. And when you step back and have a look at some of those interventions, and I think the thromboprophylaxis versus therapeutic anticoagulation is an important one, there's potentially incredible harm on this. And we really do need to know we're doing the right thing before we change. What I'm seeing is that we are changing practice on the basis of the data which is available to us, the clinicians who are making the decisions and seeing the patients, as a much lower level. So we're acting on press releases. We're acting on preprints before peer review. I think that's potentially harmful and potentially quite difficult for us to take forward.
Well, smart, caring physicians can look at the same information and come to different conclusions. Everyone will have a different threshold on what they consider sufficient evidence to change practice. And it's on a spectrum. There are early adopters who will jump on a press release or preprint publications, things that have not been peer-reviewed. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there are nihilists throwing up their hands, nothing works, and until I have definitive evidence, I am not moving on this. Simon, what's the harm of just trying?
Well, the harm in just trying is you might be wrong. And there's many, many examples in medicine where what seemed like a good idea at the time turned out to be harmful. The second reason is you might be distracted. So you might spend a lot of time, effort, or money or costs giving a treatment which turns out to not work. And that's a waste of resources. And it also, as we talked about before, it may lose you the opportunity to test it later. So, for instance, if we'd have all adopted drug A for COVID-19 on the basis of no evidence, it would then take quite a lot of evidence to stop people from giving drug A. Because once it's established in practice, it's quite hard to stop people doing it. And I think that's really important that we don't start doing things until the evidence is there. And I think we're already seeing this. I'm going to go back to hydroxychloroquine again, because I still know that that drug is being used widely across the world. And at the moment, as it currently stands on this day today, we've not found good evidence that it works. Now, I'm prepared to change that tomorrow. If somebody produces a trial which says it works in this group of patients or it's a different group, fine. But at the moment, we run the risk of harming the patients, of being distracted, or losing the opportunity to test. So early adoption, no. It's choosing the right time, and that's difficult.
Well, one example you give from pre-pandemic times is that of vitamin C for sepsis. And we've covered that back on SJAM number 174.
So vitamin C is really interesting. we had Paul Marek do before and after studies, which when we first saw them, a lot of us thought were too good to be true, because I think the mortality benefit from using what was known as the Marek cocktail was fantastic. But since then, there's been a number of other trials looking at that or very similar protocols, and they've not really shown any reproduction of that incredible result that Marek got. And that's good science. We should reproduce trials. We should change them, and we should do them again, and we should look in different groups. But we've not found that it works. So the EBM principle here is that we use the best evidence until we know better. So at the moment, there's no real evidence for vitamin C. But I'm quite happy that if tomorrow you come up with a better trial in a different group or with different inclusion criteria or a different time in the illness and you show benefit, I'll change. I'll be quite happy about that. And one of the things that we put into the paper, which is relevant to the vitamin C thing and all of these things, is this concept of what we call evidence-based agility. And it means that we as EBM practitioners need to respond with that agility of thought and deed. And it means that we have to admit that we're wrong as often as we're right. And if you think about it, Ken, I've always felt that in order to change, we've got to accept that the past was wrong as much as we've got to accept that what the new evidence is right. And maybe we need to think a little bit more about change, in that half of it's, yes, adopting the new evidence, but half of it's about leaving something behind. And maybe we need to teach and understand and educate on how we get rid of our past knowledge in order to accept the new.
Yes, I've often stated I've been wrong in the past, and I probably will be wrong in the future. And I like this idea of flexibility and agility. Sometimes a criticism of evidence-based medicine proponents is that we're too rigid or we have a fixed mindset. And actually, I think we're more open-minded because, just like you, if presented with good evidence on a treatment that would have a patient-oriented outcome, I'll adopt it. But what I need is sufficient, convincing evidence to make that change. But I'm willing to make that change. My mind is open. But as someone famously said, my mind isn't so open to let my brain fall out. So there has to be some pretest probability. There has to be some Bayesian thinking involved in that. When the Marek study came out and it was too good to be true, and you think about it, what intervention do we have in sepsis, such a horrible, horrible disease that has a large spectrum of presentation with regards to underlying causes, could have such a remarkable mortality difference? And so right there, it seemed too good to be true, given the existing literature on it. And so, just like you, if they come out tomorrow and publish a great, well-designed study that shows that vitamin C cocktail works for sepsis and provides a patient-oriented outcome, I too will change my position and say so publicly. Now, you did mention earlier some of the potential harms. I wonder if you could go through that just a little bit more, just in a little bit more detail about the harms of adapting a treatment modality without good evidence.
So in a little bit more detail, there's several things that can happen if we adopt things without getting the good evidence behind them. We may simply be distracted. We may spend our time doing a therapy, and some of these therapies take quite a bit of time to deliver. And it turns out that that was a waste of time, and we could be doing something else with more benefit, even if it's just simple supportive care. I think there's also the issue of hope, that we put a lot of our efforts on the idea that there will be a magic bullet. There'll be something that will just find this. It'll be make everything okay. And that's not a good way of thinking about COVID-19 or any particularly infectious diseases. We're always going to have to look at a package of care. We're going to have to look at lots of other factors, not just therapy, but diagnostics, about the epidemiology, about risk factors and other things. We can't just think that there's going to be a magic bullet. This is a very, very significant disease, and it's going to take an enormous package of interventions for us to get everybody through it. In areas which don't have a lot of resources, and I think you and I are very lucky because we work in high-income countries, but I'm really worried that countries that don't have, or health economies that don't have the resources that we have, would spend the little money that they have on therapies which don't work. And I don't want low and middle-income countries spending their money on things which turn out to be of no value. I think it's also important that we think about how the patients may change. and giving the false hope to relatives and to patients themselves that if you have this therapy, you will get better. And in fact, we know that that's not the case. And I'm also particularly worried that if we don't investigate the therapies now, we'll lose that concept of clinical equipoise. At the moment, at the beginning of this pandemic, we genuinely did not know at all whether anything would work because we'd never seen this disease before. And that's a really interesting time to be in science because we don't normally have that at all. And it's a great way to do science because genuinely equipoise exists. It's a great way to design studies from that position of true equipoise. But if we start adopting a load of therapies, the equipoise will disappear and it will make it more difficult for us to do well-designed trials. It will make it more difficult to recruit. It will make it more difficult to recruit into populations who may not be that interested or able or have the opportunity to get into clinical trials. And all of those things end up with longer time, lower quality of studies, and less applicability. It moves us away from evidence-based medicine. So when we decide what we're going to believe and when we're going to change, we've got to remember all of these potential harms as well as potentially the benefits.
Simon, I want to pull out one thing that you said in that last section, and that was about false hope. I've heard some family members and some family friends ask, "What would you want if it was you who got COVID-19? And this could be an appeal to emotion, another logical fallacy. But how do you respond to that question?
It's a really interesting question. And it's not come up for us during COVID-19. It's something we've thought about for many, many years. And I don't remember who I got this from. It's not my original thought. But for me, if you want to really genuinely know what I would do, and I've said this to all my family and friends, is that in the event of a pandemic or in any condition where I end up going to hospital or I need treatment in healthcare, please enroll me in whatever clinical trial is going on at that time. Because I have faith that most clinical trials are done in good faith and that we know that there's moderate evidence, I guess, out there that even if you're in the placebo group of something like a randomized control trial, you do better than if you're on standard care. So I'm quite happy, particularly during COVID-19, when we don't have the evidence and we do have equipoise, the answer is put me in the trial and I'll go with a randomization because I know that that's my better option than not doing it at all.
Now, Simon, you offer 4 suggestions on the way forward. Why could you have not have come up with one more or split one into 2 so you could at least have my favorite number of 5? That sounds fair enough. All right. The first strategy that you talk about is ensuring that COVID-19 patients have the opportunity to enter a clinical trial.
I'm passionate about this, not just about COVID-19, but for emergency medicine patients in general. And I want you to think oncology. If you have cancer in the UK and you go to one of our excellent cancer hospitals, you're going to be offered very, very, very commonly the opportunity to enter a clinical trial because there's so much research going on in oncology. We need to do the same in emergency medicine. And certainly in COVID-19, there are big trials out there. Everybody should be getting out there and making sure that their departments have the opportunity to recruit patients. And I'll give you an example. In the UK, the recovery trial, it was done in 175 different hospitals. It's already recruited over 12,000 patients. But even then, we only recruited about 1 in 5, 1 in 6 patients who came through the door. But think of the power of that. Think about what we could have done already had we given the opportunity to get all our patients into clinical trials.
All right, Simon, what's your second strategy?
The second strategy is principle of evidence-based medicine, is that the trials should be of high quality. I'm sad that this needs to be said. But when we started at the beginning of this pandemic, we saw large numbers of very small trials, 50, 60, 100 patients, non-randomized, before and after studies, which were interesting. They're hypothesis generating to some extent, but they're not really going to answer our questions. And so it's really important that we think about the design. yes, we have this pressure of time and the pace and scale of the pandemic, but just with a little forethought, a little planning, and maybe just waiting a little bit longer, we can get better quality studies. And that's really important. So engage your statisticians, your epidemiologists, your trial designers. Make sure you're doing good quality research.
All right, that's number two. What do you got for number three?
Number three was to use the power of machine learning and artificial intelligence. Now, I've got a little bit of a caution on this one because there's been some controversy. But if you think, certainly in a health economy like the UK, where we have a nationalized health service, we can collect data on huge numbers of patients across the country, even if they're not in an intervention trial. We can look at observational data. And that has already been used in some of the trials in the UK, which are going to report soon. Certainly been used in the UK trials where we've looked at the characteristics of patients coming through the door in all of our hospitals across the country. And therefore, we can draw some inferences about who's likely to be suffering from the disease and what their prognosis is. The caution with this is there were those trials which were withdrawn both in the Lancet and in the New England Journal of Medicine using the Surgisphere data because they weren't prepared to release that for peer review. So if you're going to do this, we have to do it in a way which is safe, which has the consent, which is fair to patients, which is suitably anonymized and can still meet the standards of evidence-based medicine, peer review, and critical appraisal.
All right, that's number three. What was your fourth and final strategy?
So my fourth and final one is an appeal to the platform adaptive design type studies. And we've seen this. So in brief, the UK prepared for the next flu pandemic by designing a number of trials in advance that were ready to go. These were done several years ago because we knew a pandemic was coming. And that allowed us, when it hit, to activate these really quickly. It's a brilliant way of getting good quality data out of a pandemic like this. But they're also adaptive designs. So there's no sample size calculation. In fact, the therapies that we're going to put into the trial will change. So drugs in trial-like recovery can come in and go out, and a new drug can come in, and we can test that. So these studies can go on for a long, prolonged period of time, adopting new therapies, testing them, discarding them, or proving them. And that adaptability is something which we don't normally see, but you can see the obvious advantage in a pandemic like this, which is going to go on for a period of time with large numbers of patients. So think about internationally how we get those trials set up for the next pandemic, because I'm afraid, Ken, it's quite likely that we're going to get one. We are, in fact, overdue a flu pandemic. So that was my four. Have you thought of any more?
Well, thank you for describing the four. And yes, I've been thinking and reflecting on what could be a fifth strategy. Now, this could be used at all times, not just during a global pandemic. The fifth strategy that I would suggest is be skeptical and teach critical thinking skills to other clinicians and to the public so that they are less likely to be fooled by all the poor arguments on social media.
Ken, I agree completely. And I think your point about making sure that we educate beyond those who already are sold on this, who already believe in evidence-based medicine, and that we do get those arguments out into social media, that we talk to our friends and families and colleagues, I think is incredibly important. Can't agree with you more.
Well, there was a great quote that I stumbled upon recently, and it was on the website, The Logic of Science. And this is about global pandemic science. And I'm just going to read it to you because I was really moved by it. I thought it was a fantastic quote. It says, over the course of the COVID crisis, we have repeatedly seen leading scientists and scientific organizations change their recommendations, and we have seen multiple scientific studies retracted or at least debated. Many view this as proof that science doesn't work and/or scientists don't know what they're doing. In reality, this is exactly what we would expect to see when science works. Science is a method, not a body of facts, and the method is often messy. Peer review does not end with publication. Rather, studies are subjected to the scrutiny of the entire scientific community. And the fact that high-profile papers sometimes get retracted is evidence of science correcting itself. Similarly, the fact that scientists change their views as new evidence about a novel virus come to light is a good thing. It means that scientists are learning and adjusting their views rather than clinging to biases and preconceptions. That's how science works. End of quote. And boy, do I like that quote. Do you have any final thoughts, Simon, about EBM during a global pandemic?
Just to say, I think that quote is absolutely fantastic, Ken. I've been nodding away in the background here whilst you've been talking through it. Totally agree. My final thoughts are two, and I'll take them from the paper if that's okay. I mean, the first is, I genuinely believe that the urgency and the severity of this COVID-19 pandemic, it does contain threats and opportunities to how we as clinicians practice EBM. And secondly, that the principles of evidence-based medicine, if we go back to what it originally meant, are now more important than perhaps at any other time in our careers. And we, you know, you, me, all of our friends, everybody, must collectively do all that we can to ensure that our response to the pandemic is based on the science and not on the emotional, the political, or economic issues that challenge it. And I think we echo the call from yourself and many others for critical reasoning, critical appraisal, and critical thinking during this time.
Well, thank you, Simon, for being a guest skeptic again on this SGEM Extra, talking about evidence-based medicine and COVID-19.
It's been an absolute delight, and I thank you again for all that you do. It is the premier EBM podcast in the world.
Well, the SGEM will be back next episode doing a structured critical appraisal of a recent publication trying to cut that KT window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year using the power of social media, so patients get the best care based on the best evidence. Simon, could you do me the honor of reading the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you've heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.